you could roll the tape. Want to welcome you all here tonight. My name is Dan Spencer, and I'm one of the teaching staff coordinators for the summer. And we try to do a couple different forums each week of different topics of lively interest, current interest to the church, to society, to our communities. The title of this forum is Patriotism and Faith, How Do We Raise Our Children? Just a word about forums at Holden, and then we'll go. I've got some panelists here to get our conversation started. It's been a long-standing tradition at Holden. If you've been here before, you probably have sat in on some of the different forums. We try to gather a couple times a week as a village to just have a chance to talk to each other in an informal setting about issues that are important to us. And given that we just celebrated the 4th of July on the 5th of July yesterday, and today is the 6th of July, we thought this would be an interesting topic to think about. So I've asked Barbara Rossing, who's doing our Bible study this week, to open us with just a few comments about biblical perspectives on relationship between the state or country and faith. And then Mark Wilhelm, who is very familiar with American history, is going to talk just briefly about some of the different ways or tensions that this has happened historically here. And then Pete Cleaver and Laura Wilhelm have got some, I think, really fascinating personal experiences out of their own family history that bring up some of these issues. But before I turn it over to Barb to get us started, I was just thinking a little bit about my own experience with this particular topic, and I realized it started fairly early on. I was, as a child, not aware of this being an issue, there being any question about whether there would ever be a conflict between patriotism and faith. The earliest experience I remember was about first or second grade. There was a student in my class who didn't say the Pledge of Allegiance when the rest of us children all stood up and pledged allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And I found out that she had permission not to do so for religious reasons. And I remember asking my parents about this. It seemed strange. Why would somebody not be able to say the Pledge of Allegiance? So that was kind of the earliest thing. The other thing, a couple things that brought this to the fore for me was, one, beginning to realize that the different generations in my family had very different understandings of what patriotism meant. And I think particularly my father's generation, which grew up during the Depression, and then he came of age as a young adult during World War II, had a very different sense than I did growing up during the sort of the 60s and the Civil Rights Movement and coming of age as a young man during the Vietnam War. And so I remember some really heated discussions in our family about what does it mean to be really patriotic, and then if you bring in the religious questions as well. And the third one that became very poignant for me, we phrased it as subtitle as How Do We Raise Our Children? Because this is something that almost all of us have contact with children, whether they're our own children, in our extended family, whether they're in schools or communities. But 10 or 15 years ago, I was spending a lot of time in Latin America, largely out of faith reasons in Central America. And I find myself oftentimes during those times in opposition to the United States foreign policy of what was going on in El Salvador and Guatemala and Nicaragua. At the same time, I was working as a nanny for a year with four small children, and I also had several nieces and nephews. And so I was constantly talking to children, and they were raising questions about what I was doing in Central America. And so I found myself both speaking out of a faith perspective, but also trying to explain why I was sometimes opposed to what our country was doing, and them raising the question, but, you know, is that patriotic? They didn't put it in so many words. But that was essentially the kind of question we had. And so I realized this question has come up many times in my life, and I imagine it has for many of us as well. So let's get started with just getting some background thoughts on it and a couple stories, and then we'll open it up for your own thoughts, your own experiences about how you've approached this. Mark, do you have your hand up?
No.
No, okay, sorry. All right, Barbara, why don't you...
Well, just a few things. As I was driving here last week across the country, the West, it's so beautiful. I mean, I did have a renewed sense of how much I love this land and this place. It's just incredible to drive all the way across Montana and Idaho and everything. Maybe some of you had that experience. I stopped in Billings, and I have a friend who runs a nursing home there, and in the nursing home was the little devotional book, Portals of Prayer. I don't know if any of you know that one. And leading up to the 4th of July, the devotionals were all very patriotic for the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th of July, drawing on Old Testament texts about the nation Israel. And then you could tell through the little devotional that the person had written and the prayers that they were viewing this now in terms of the United States and our patriotic sense about our country. I think that's a little problematic biblically. for one thing, so much of both the Old and New Testaments were written under occupation by foreign governments. So some of the nationalistic dreams of Old Testament passage about Israel are in fact written because someone else was occupying or controlling Israel. They weren't written out of a sense of actual power and control of the nation itself. And then certainly the New Testament, every book of the New Testament is written at a time when Rome is the empire, the dominant empire, the only one that has any power. In Galilee and Palestine, this meant a harsh kind of Roman occupation. Other areas, maybe Asia Minor, you could argue it wasn't so difficult, but the New Testament authors are all struggling to figure out what does it mean to live under this kind of empire. What do you do to stay alive? How far do you accommodate yourself to this rather oppressive situation? We're discovering increasingly in New Testament studies how it was oppressive. It would have meant a legitimation of slaveholding and colonizing peoples. So you see a range of positions in the New Testament. We talked about that in Bible study this morning, all the way from Romans 13 that seems to say that government is instituted by God and Christians should obey it. You see that in 1 Peter and other texts as well, but certainly Revelation 13 is the very opposite, that says you cannot have any accommodation to the government. You can't have anything to do with government. It's evil. It's demonic. They're all responding to the same government, to the same imperial situation, but they just do it differently. But I think what that means for us today biblically is certainly a degree of healthy caution about applying text about Israel to our country and struggling with issues of how God's people are called to respond to oppressive situations in the world, like Dan described, where people have really felt marginalization. And that's what I'm sort of working on in the Bible study this morning. But just to, I guess, say it does trouble me when the Bible is used to sort of lift up a kind of blind patriotism and by analogy, apply Old Testament text about Israel to our country.
Thanks, Mark.
Dan said that this being the week of the celebration of Independence Day helped prompt the topic for the forum. And one take on the question then, rooted in the ideals of this nation, is that the question being posed here from American ideals would not be approached by the more obvious take on it of a kind of false patriotism, like Barbara was talking about, claiming that we find a resolve the tension between faith and patriotism by saying this is God's land in a simple, superficial and simple way, or by taking the other tack and saying can't pledge allegiance to the flag, it's all evil, or it's all evil because the nation's doing evil in Central America, or whatever. But the ideal of the nation has been that we can, in fact, hold together these multiplicity of loyalties and yet maintain ourselves as a single nation. The challenge, one of the challenges of this republic has been to assert that contrary to what's been commonly put forth as a common sense reality in cultures globally, as I said to Dan the other day, based on Jane Goodall's research and other research, apparently within other animal cultures as well, gorillas fighting around certain forms, demanding a certain unitary system in their culture and so on, or they go to war with each other. Outside of the experiment of the United States, there had been up until that point an assertion unless certain conformities were held, you couldn't hold together the nation as a unit. The quintessential example, of course, being religion, and that all of our heritage of separation of church and state, no tests for citizenship, federal citizenship, no tests for holding positions in the federal government based on religion. That was a grand experiment based on religious diversity that you could in fact maintain a a unity of patriotism and religion, despite the diversity within that. And we have been pushing the envelope on that question ever since. The ideal, one of the ideals of the American experiment has been to keep pushing how far can you expand the diversity and maintain the unity of the nation state. It's a fundamental sort of bedrock question in American culture. So we expanded it to the diversity of Protestant, back in the old church and state stuff originally, it was Protestant diversity, Northern Euro-American stuff. And then we pushed it, we said, but you can't be Catholic. And now we pushed it to Roman Catholicism, rest of European cultures, push it toward other global cultures, toward issues of men and women, now into issues of heterosexual and homosexual, gay, lesbian. We keep pushing how diverse can the culture be and still maintain a unity of a nation state. The ideal says it can be as diverse may be, which is the kind of inherent notion of a tension that can be held together of a pluralistic unity. It's a very, very difficult thing to flesh out this e pluribus unum thing, but it's pluribus and unum, always at the same time in the American ideal.
Thanks, Mark. Pete's our medic in the village.
Yeah, I guess I have to begin by telling you kind of the story of how, as a child, my strongest influence in teaching me about patriotism and faith was my father, who, my grandparents were Mennonite missionaries in Montana, and he was raised pretty strictly Mennonite. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Mennonites, there was a lot of things that, even at that time, went against being part of a nationalistic. You couldn't take a pledge, you were forbidden from taking a pledge. They were nonviolent and pacifists, at least at that time, some branches were. And he and his brother both went to college at Wheaton. They both graduated at the same time, and they couldn't both afford to go to medical school, so they flipped a coin, and my father lost. And so he was pledged to put my uncle through medical school, and he did that by joining the Marines. And becoming a fighter pilot, and it happened to be 1939. And for that, he was obviously a little bit ostracized from the church, both for taking a pledge to the United States and for obviously being in a military. But at that time, he would tell you that he was very caught up in the fervor of the war and was a Marine all the way. And he first assignment during the war was Wake Island, and he was captured December 29th after 3 weeks of hand-to-hand combat and some very, very difficult times for him, and spent 4 years in a prisoner of war camp in Japan. And during that time, he started to try to deal with a lot of the horrors that were inflicted upon him and that he inflicted upon others. And he had two books through the Red Cross. One was the Bible and one was Grey's Anatomy. And so one led him to apply to medical school, and the other one, he started reading the Bible again from a perspective of what he'd been through, not just from, it'd been very difficult for him as a child to deal with the Bible and a lot of the scripture, just because it was more or less just what, it wasn't something that had emotion behind it, it was just rote to him. But the one thing that stuck in his mind and ever since then was the Sermon on the Mount. And he became a devout pacifist after the war, obviously, and spent a lot of time, rest of his life, dedicating his time and energy to nonviolence, including when I was growing up, a lot of the Vietnam War, returning his medals to the president and leading a lot of marches. And so he taught me a lot about what it meant to be both patriotic on one hand and being very true to the faith. And for me, the lesson I learned from him is that they do come into conflict a lot of times, that the main thing that you have to remember is that you do have a set of principles, and your faith demands of you a higher law and a higher calling than what your nation does. Not to say that you don't value your nation and the services it provides for you, you do everything you can to support your nation, but when they conflict, such as in wartime, you have to go with your higher calling. And for him, that was, and for me, that is the way of nonviolence. And he always taught me that there is no such thing as a just war. He felt he'd studied a lot of the just war theory and felt that that he couldn't support that, because he always said that there can't be any, so there's nothing as bad as war that can justify it. That really war is the most horrible thing you can go through. And so that's what shaped my life too. And I think that's I try and follow those highest principles, as difficult as that is, not just in wartime, but as with our vow of nonviolence in our everyday lives, which is even harder at times.
Thanks, Pete. And Laura Wilhelm is a member of our teaching staff.
Patriotism and faith have kind of, I guess, in a way, since I've started thinking about this a little bit, run together in my life. My parents immigrated from Latvia at the end of the Second World War. They were brought here through the work of the Lutheran World Federation. So right from the start, you know, they wouldn't have been here if it wasn't for the Lutheran Church. They came into the United States. They were placed with people. They had no other family here, either one of them. They came in separately at that point. They didn't know each other. My dad worked on a farm for a Quaker farm couple, and my mom worked as a housekeeper and nanny in North Carolina for an army officer. And eventually they ended up in Ohio together. But it was through the act of the works of the Lutheran World Federation that they came. They were always grateful. That was part of the stories of growing up. Grew up in a small town in Ohio. Went to church pretty regularly, especially when, as I realized that my parents didn't grow up going to church all the time. It wasn't part of their culture. You went maybe once a month, maybe four times a year, you know. They became part of the local congregation there. They became its custodians at the church as their part-time jobs. So our life revolved around the church, but yet there was always this piece in our life that was different from everybody else's, most of in our small town especially, that because they came from a different place. And as I started to think about it, the rules in our family were that when we were in public, it was not polite to speak Latvian. We all spoke Latvian at home, but when we were in public, because, you know, what would other people think we might be saying about them or something like that. And so we had there were rules about how you were a part of the society that you came into, you know, how you were a polite part of that. And in a way for me, that is a sense of patriotism. I mean, we weren't talking about the flag, we weren't talking so much about governments, you know, but we were talking about behavior and about an attitude towards the country that took you in, took us in. Even though I was born here, I'm first generation American, but you know, I was very much a part of who my parents were at that point. And so I've thought about things from that perspective, and that's pretty much how I grew up, thinking, you know, we may be a little bit different, but it's part of who we are, and that we are thankful to this country. And then as I started thinking about this over the past couple of days, and Mark asked me, he said, well, but your parents never became citizens. And they didn't. And they, you know, they carried green cards, alien registration cards, their entire lives. They went every year to the post office and renewed those cards. And I'm not sure why. It's one of those questions. You wish your parents were still alive so that at this point in your life you could ask them, you know, why didn't you guys ever become citizens? And I don't know the answer to that. And so that's kind of the topping here. You know, that's the question that remains open. And, you know, friends of my parents, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, some of them went back to find their land and to reclaim it, their homes, their farms. You have to remember, this is 40 years later. There have been people living on that land for a long, long time. And so, you know, and one of them called me and said, you and your brother must go back and claim the land. And And I, that raised another question. You know, how can you, who am I, you know, where, what is my country? You know, I could claim that land on behalf of my parents, but yet even though it was a very difficult decision that my parents made, I've always felt that they did make a decision. That, you know, this, the times were very difficult, but they did have a choice, and you always have a choice, is my view on things. They could have stayed. Who knows what the consequences would have been, but they could have stayed. You know. And so it's in, and then Mark asked me, well, do you think your parents would have gone back if they were alive, since they had never become citizens of the United States? And I said, my first response was automatically no. I mean, everything I know says that they would not have gone back. But I'm not absolutely sure, you know. So there's that question that's always run through our lives, my brother's life and my life, you know, of being Americans but not quite, you know, and that feeling of always being slightly set apart. I you know, I don't know exactly what it means to think about if your family was in the United States since the 1700s, and whether you have a different feeling than I do in that case. I guess I'd have to think that you probably, that people probably do. You know, that maybe there is a greater sense of ownership. Maybe there is less of a sense of questioning. I'm not sure. Maybe that's being too broad on it. But, and all of a sudden the picture of Richard Nixon hanging on my uncle's wall flashed through my mind too, so I don't know what that means. But you know, they, yeah, I didn't get it either, even at that time. So anyhow, that's just a little piece of where I come from on this.
Let's throw it open at this point for other folks. What are your thoughts on this issue? What I always find it very interesting. I mean, the reason we don't have to focus on the second part of how we raise our children, but I think it sharpens the question about what gets passed on. What how do we wrestle with these questions when we think about the children whose lives we're interacting with and whom we're teaching about what are our deepest values, and when we have things that make claims on our allegiance, as our faith does and as our nation does, how do we wrestle with that? We got some folks in the balcony and some down here. Yeah.
My name is Carter Hansen. I'll just, this question is interesting to me from a couple of perspectives. One is, I guess, personally growing up, I can't remember being raised with a strong sense of patriotism. My family wasn't of a military background of any kind, and war seemed to be often a focal point of nationalist sentiment, and so I didn't grow up with a strong sense of that. And then, so I've always, I guess, been a little bit skeptical of people who are sort of, you know, rah, 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 you know, go America. And that feeling gets, has been reinforced for me from an academic standpoint. I teach English, and in some of the work that I've got, there's been a lot of scholarly work in the last, say, 15 years on nationalism. It's become a very sort of hot topic since, I think it was around 1983, a guy named Benedict Anderson wrote a book called Imagined Communities about that nationalism is sort of are myths or stories that people tell about themselves that to give themselves a sense of origin. And that these, and a lot of other people have written about how sort of these myths of origin are used by dominant societies to sort of justify their superiority and their position of power over other societies. And so it becomes a sort of a tool of imperialism. Mm-hmm. So I think from a scholar perspective, nationalism in a lot of ways in the last couple of decades is started to become equated with fanaticism. That if you have a strong sense of patriotism or love for your country, that you know you're a fanatic, and that you're kind of dangerous, or you know, automatically considered very right wing or something like that. So there, I have a sort of background of being somewhat skeptical, but I've also this past year. I did, one of the courses I was teaching, we were teaching some of the founding American documents, like the Declaration of Independence, the Gettysburg Address and we read the Constitution. And that was actually a pretty powerful experience for me to take a close look at those documents and talk about them with a group of first-year college students. And it made me reflect on, you know, how unique and how special, you know, American democracy is, and, you know, how long it's, you know, been around. And think about the attempts at other at democracy that have been made in other parts of the world. So many times they failed, but, you know, American democracy has, you know, lasted over 200 years, and that's a pretty incredible thing if you actually stop to think about it. And I got actually pretty excited about teaching that idea, you know, those ideas with my students and talking about, you know, this is something, it is pretty special to have the kind of system of government and that we have here, and that it's something to cherish and not simply take for granted or to badmouth. So I guess I've had some sort of, and I'm thinking about it now, well, I have a little daughter, and so what am I going to tell her when she gets old enough to start thinking about these things? I don't really know yet. But.
Well, I guess that brings up the topic. I mean, I guess I would always wonder what the people's definition of patriotism is. What does it really mean to be patriotic? Does it mean supporting a government no matter what? Or does it, I guess I would wonder what people thought about their definition of patriotism.
That was my question too, is patriotism loyalty to the country? And so then are we talking about loyalty to the country versus loyalty to God? Would that be a definition of faith?
Well, and I was struck by that too, because Barb, you started yours off, which is one place where I always went to, which is this sense of a deep love of this land and this connected to it. And part of my love is also part of the history and the traditions and the political system we have, but part of it's not. Part of it is also the real land itself and the place, and that. And knowing that much of that history, that land has had a lot of tragedy as well, you know, can lead to a kind of more and more critical sort of wrestling. So I find myself sometimes torn between love of God, love of country, love of land, and those three really being interwoven in ways that are hard for me to sort out.
Right? I think you have to make some distinctions with love of country too, right? Because what Carter was talking about really, what he was saying was some of the ideals for which the country stands. Now, but when you're faced, say, with a particular war, you're not necessarily talking about ideals, you're talking about a particular government policy in a particular concrete situation. And so it's possible to oppose that particular policy and even invoke, perhaps, the ideals at times over against that particular policy. Now, I would think in reference to Central America that would have been one of the elements in the mix there for you.
And I guess one of the strongest examples of how quickly patriotism or nationalism can rise is, I think, the Persian Gulf War. How quickly, I mean, it was very scary for me to see how quickly public sentiment went for that and how people were literally ostracized in the press for opposing that war, that you were opposing, you just saw this marketing scheme go out of, if you're against the war, you're against the soldiers, you hate the soldiers, it's going to be Vietnam all over again, and you're going to come back and you're going to, you know, I that was a very scary thing for me. And I guess that brings up the other point about how it can be used by people, used by elements of the government or corporations or whatever for their own gain. And it's not necessarily out of a love for the country, it's a love for whatever their agenda is. And I guess I would see that as a negative side of patriotism, if that's what you want to call it, patriotism. I still have a trouble with the definition of what that is, but that very often, I think, is equated with what patriotism is, this fervor for going into a conflict.
I'll give you a definition of patriotism from the perspective I was trying to raise. It simply requires that one is willing to acknowledge he or she is a citizen of this country, B, that you'll follow the procedures set forth in the Constitution, and C, take up no violent means to overthrow the constitutional government of the United States. If you're willing to do that, and that idealistic vision of holding all of these opinions, cultural, religious, and social and ethnic diversities and policy perspectives and tension, if you're willing to follow those three things, the ideal is you all those tensions, all those perspectives, backgrounds, and characters can be held in tension and indeed expanded and worked through. But that's usually not enough of a definition to make anybody happy, which is why the debate goes on. But it's all that the ideal requires, that you're willing to be a citizen, acknowledge the procedures of the Constitution, and not take up violent means to overthrow constitutionally elected government.
And Mark, let me push on that then. Does that also then require creation and maintenance of a civic culture? I was very struck the other night, was it just last night? I guess it was, when we were all gathered in Village Center. We have people from all over the country. Most of us have not known each other before, but there was certainly enough commonality. We all knew what it was like to experience fireworks. We all knew. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a lot of Americana mm-hmm. culture in that room, and you could draw on. And so much of the humor was because, you know, we knew what was a real 4th of July was like, and the whole day was a lot like that. And so, is patriotism in part rooted in having enough commonality in a culture as well as just the things that you've mentioned, and where does that then become problematic?
In certain circles, this is called the bowling alone debate. I don't know if you folks are familiar with that article, an essay written by a fellow who's at Harvard, actually a political scientist of central Italian politics. He wrote an article called Bowling Alone, and that the social capital of the United States was being spent down. And his anecdotal reference to this was that the number of bowling leagues was decreasing rapidly, but the number of people bowling in the United States was rapidly on the rise. And that, like Italy, which has not been able to sustain a stable governmental structure where there is a lot of group activity, where there's a building of a common sense of civic culture, that we were in danger in the United States of degenerating into that kind of socio-political chaos, not being able to sustain structures and so on, always having governments thrown out of office and the attendant bureaucratic chaos, because we were surrendering up the long-standing building of social and political capital that has been observed since the 18th century in this country, where we always form committees, have groups, have 4th of July celebrations around the band shell, building all these collective activities, and now we're becoming this nation of just individuals doing our individual thing, and that therefore it will start to fall apart, the patriotism or the commitment to the basic constitutional structures that I was saying was required. That the sustenance of those does require this sort of activity. I think the problem for us is really sort of the other direction. That is, I tend to think that can't prove this. Don't have a good argument on this. The impulses that are necessary to sustain those basic commitments that I outlined a minute ago, in fact, do come not from community building, but in fact come from the government. This is another fundamental tension that I haven't been able to sort out. When we approach a question like the kind of question we're approaching tonight, we tend to want to talk about limited government and government being less aggressive than it often is. When we raise the question from the angle that you started us now, Dan, we want more of a positive and fuller government that's going to provide positive direction and laws for encouraging us along the right path. It's the Great Society and so on and so forth. We don't want certain things, but we want other things. I tend to think, and this is where my own living with the ideal that I'm familiar with, but I can't quite figure out, has difficulty, because I do think that the source of the success of the ideal comes not just from kind of village green community building, but from very positive directions and impulses out of the central government. And we've been sometimes good at that and not good at that, but when we've been good at it, it has worked well in this land so far.
I have a question. Does the Constitution provide for drought refusal?
The Supreme Court says the Constitution does. The words are not there.
So you can be patriotic and refuse the drought.
It was certainly a big debate when I was growing up.
Still a question for me.
My country, right or wrong, America, love it or leave it, and then kind of CO status, and was that a patriotic act or was that a betrayal?
Mm-hmm. Remember, the Constitution in its guts actually says we don't have a military. One of the major, again, back to the ideals, the greatest threats to liberty, right? All that old rhetoric is a standing army. The tool of a tyrant, tyrannies, standing armies, the tools of all the troubles that you're talking about are standing armies. So the Constitution says Congress can create a military, but it goes out of business after 2 years. It's got to be reestablished. Of course, we reestablish it every 2 years, but the Constitution is very suspect of standing military forces. It's to put a negative spin on this, it's the source of all the Phi Zappa crappa coming out of the militia movement and of conservatives.
Jack, you had a hand up.
Well, I was going to say, at some levels, this is a very simple question for me, and at some levels, it's not. And I guess I would start with, how do we raise our children? I remember very specifically having a conversation with Hannah when she was in the first grade and came home and happened to, in her school, hit probably one of a handful of teachers who had their students, at least in the beginning of the year, say the Pledge of Allegiance. And Hannah came back and was a little bit miffed about that, or didn't really know what to do or what she should think or what our family might think. We're always looking for guidance. And I said, well, what did you do? And she said, well, it seemed reasonable to me. I didn't want to stand up, and I didn't want to say it. But I decided that I would stand up, but I wouldn't say it. So that's what I worked out with the teacher. And then she asked, and I said, well, I think, that's very... You made some really good choices, and but I tried to explain to her that as a Christian, we have one ultimate allegiance, and so any other allegiance is provisional, and that for me makes me very uncomfortable to say an allegiance to a flag, for example. So I think there is a pretty hard and fast conflict between the one and the other, the faith and the other. And that doesn't mean that you are always in opposition to the nation, that you're always in opposition to everything that it does. But it means that there is a dividing line in which you do make judgments based on how you understand Jesus, in our case. A couple other thoughts that came to mind. One was, I think at the extreme end of things is probably Bonhoeffer's prayer, where he said that the most patriotic thing that he could do in Nazi Germany was to pray for the defeat of his country. And quite frankly, I have found myself in numbers of situations where that has been my prayer, that I have prayed for the defeat of my country's policies in Central America. I've prayed for the defeat of the Central Intelligence Agency's maneuverings throughout Latin America. And I think I feel free to do that because I'm grounded in trying to make sense out of who Jesus is and what he taught. And then maybe the last point for me that gets a little mushy here is that I don't think there would necessarily need to be a conflict between nonviolence and patriotism. But in our culture, I think it's inevitable because we invest nothing in nonviolence as a people or as a nation. We spend huge amounts of resources on militarization of all forms. And so I would like to think that ideally one could be very patriotic. For example, if our country were invaded unjustly by another country, I would nonviolently resist that occupation. I don't know that that would be considered patriotic in this society. I have a feeling I'd be written off as an enemy. So I think that commitment to nonviolence for me is also rooted in that ultimacy of faith and a grounding and understanding of Jesus. So those are just some thoughts.
Part of this, I would like to say that Jack gives me an example of the kind of point I was trying to make earlier and couldn't come up with an example. But in point of fact, I think you're right, Jack. If you took that stance, you would have in this society, and let's differentiate the society-government thing, great opposition if we were occupied to taking a nonviolent response to that occupation. Our government has more of a likelihood, if the extent that the government continued to exist, of allowing you to do that than the society as a whole. Constitutional procedures, again, patriotism, following the constitutional procedures, requires that there be a positive government. This is an example of why we need the government to act more than just gathering on the community green, whether it be the government stepping in and saying, you gotta let those African-American kids enroll in that school, or it's the government stepping in, we're not gonna let you lynch Jack because he's not signing up for the militia in our free sector that's going to organize against the occupational army. You can't lynch Jack. The government will say that and allow him to sit there and be and still get his rations. The positive actions of this government over the decades, the centuries, have been more important in sustaining, in my view, the civil fabric that undergirds the ideals of this society than has the society as a whole, which can be pretty nasty sometimes. I have long-term more faith in holding in tension my allegiances to God in Christ and my ability to live in this nation as an American citizen by virtue of what the government does than what the society practices as a whole in its private and nonprofit sectors.
Can I just say something locally, although I really want to hear what other people think too, but biblically in the New Testament at least, the word citizenship is used of what we are as Christians, and it's clear, certainly for the Apostle Paul, that your primary citizenship has to be to the commonwealth of God and of the Christian, Christian citizenship, and that that is going to come into conflict with political allegiances, not always, but sometimes, and that we're all called to see ourselves in the language of citizenship. You talked, Mark, about being a prerequisite for patriotism. Maybe then a concept of dual citizenship somehow is what we're talking about, but your primary citizenship is to the Commonwealth.
How have some of the others of you encountered this in your own families or communities?
My grandfather and grandmother on my mother's side came to this country from Germany because of conscription over there in the late 1860s or so. And I don't know what war that would have been or what, but the conscription to him was not viable, not a real issue, not an issue he wanted to be with. And so his Christianity brought him and his family here. And then in our time, we come along with the inscription here that our kids went off to Canada. So, you know, it's, I don't think my own son was in the program of playing college where he's ROTC, I guess. That's anyway. But my twin sister's son went to Canada.
So you have both responses right in your family.
Yeah, I'm sure lots of families had that happen, you know. And I should even look down on my nephew for having made that decision. It was his decision. And my two boys together, I mean, there was never any problem between them on issues on how they responded to that.
Did your nephew return to the United States then? After the amnesty.
Patriotism for me is like our English teacher over here conjures up some ideas, you know. But usually, it's, to me, I see people that are very patriotic. You mix in a little bit of fear, and you mix in some ignorance, and then it gets kind of scary. And and that's frightening. That's the frightening piece about patriotism. It jumps from that, from patriotism, to something else that ends up justifying segregation and racism and a whole variety of other things. But living in Hong Kong is it's interesting because people there, U.S. citizens there, their kids don't grow up in the U.S. So there they become kind of third culture kids. They live in a European country or South Africa, or they live in Kuala Lumpur or Singapore and Hong Kong. And they don't really, I think they have a different view of America than someone that's brought up here. And then they're not sure where their home is and where their allegiance is. And I think sometimes they're a little bit confused, you know. A holiday comes around, where do I go? That sort of thing.
Another little part of my story is, you know, it was my parents left Latvia in opposition to communism. I mean, that was always a big part of things, too. But yet,
that's the reason for the Richard Nixon photo
that's,
on your uncle's wall.
Yeah, I guess that's the reason for that.
Let's say it, kids.
And but yet, you know, I also have the memory of standing at the bus stop with my brother and having stones thrown at us by other kids because and being called communists because my parents were from Russia. Latvia became a part of the Soviet Union for a while. And so there was always that. I thought, but we're not communists. That's why we left. You know, that's why my parents left. So, you know, it's part of that where do you really belong kind of question.
Well, the other thing that both of you reminded me of, too, in terms of I think I have much more ambivalence with patriotic symbols than I do with necessarily patriotism itself. And I think that's where my own experience of growing up in the 60s and the 70s has, I have such a deep-rooted ambivalence about the symbols that are used to foster what was called patriotism at that time, whether it was the flag or the Star-Spangled Banner or these particular symbols. And it's very interesting for me now as a teacher because many of my students who've grown up in a very different era, they don't remember Martin Luther King, they don't remember, you know, a lot of the different things that were really formational for me, have a very different relationship with those symbols than I do. And oftentimes don't understand my reluctance or hesitance, but I wonder if I'll ever get past that. I think they're so deeply imbued for me from that period of our nation's history that it's very hard for me to participate in certain things because of my own history there.
But in certain ways, Christian symbol. I have a hard time with Christian symbols too.
Yeah.
You know, I have I can't. I don't wear a cross.
Right.
I just, you know, it just, you know, it's fine if somebody else does it, but to me, it's just one step too much. That it's proclaiming something. You know, and, you know, I don't know. I don't want to offend anybody, but it's proclaiming for me something unnecessarily.
Right.
That it's, you know, it's stating something, and I think the cross, as it has been used in a very negative sense too. And I think because of that, we have to be careful where we use it, as careful as where we stick up an American flag, you know, or the Liberty Bell or something else.
How much could those symbols be considered idolatry in a way?
I think where patriotism is scary is when it starts to become conformity, applying conformity, and
to try and control the people. Yeah.
Yeah.
I spent Memorial Day at my sister's house in a very small town in southern Minnesota, where I hadn't been to one of these celebrations in a long time. Where you go down at 10 o'clock to the town hall. There's a little parade. I mean, everything is little in this town. But my nephew marched in the marching band, the school marching band, and then they marched into the town hall. And there were, you know, the veterans and the Legion and stuff with their guns, but only two or three guns, you know, small. And then we went into the town hall, and my brother-in-law is the choir director, so we sang these songs like America the Beautiful and In Flanders Fields, the Poppies Grow or something. And it was, you know, it was really kind of nice. It was very moving. And then the Catholic priest gave a big invocation and an address, and that was a little surprise to me. My sister's a pastor. I talked to her about whether she's ever done this, because I never would have given an invocation or address. She said, yes, she has. It's expected of pastors in small towns. And it was very kind of interesting to me to kind of, I was quite bemused and taken aback by this. On the other hand, it was fun to see, you know, the whole town come out for something like we do here in Holden. It's a real community building thing. So I was torn, I guess, over that. I don't know, do your towns have this kind of thing on Memorial Day?
A man told me once, it was an older man, that he wouldn't come back to church until they put the U.S. flag back in the sanctuary.
There are many churches in Minnesota that drape their altars with American flags.
There are? On when?
July 4th weekend.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is the altar block?
Oh my.
Seems sacrilegious.
I guess for me, a bunch of different things. This is an interesting topic. One that I really don't have thought in some way directly about. But when I think of this country, and when I talk with people, when I'm talking to foreigners or whatever, this country is definitely built on rebellion, and that is a part of our heritage. And it's and the other thing it's built on is choice. My right to have a choice, and you to have a choice, and so on. And that really goes against patriotism in some ways, in my view. And I think we have I think in this country, and I think maybe each country has their own definition of patriotism. And I think we as a country have this incredible sense of freedom and of individual freedom, and that's to be valued and respected. And I think it affects everything, as well as a rebellion issue that we have, that we have a choice, we have a choice to rebel. I think about certainly burning the American flag. We have the choice to rebel. You know, try that in some other countries, see what happens if you burn their flag. And there, in many countries, people do not have choices without heavy consequences from their government if they express themselves individually. It's a real mix. I think this country is definitely different than any other country on the planet right now. And I was thinking too about how, ROTC, which has all sorts of negative feelings in myself, you know, but again, it doesn't, I guess the point is that we have choice, and that choice can get in the way with a traditional, you know, with some definitions of patriotism. Personally, I don't think it does at all, for me. You don't have to be a robot or an automaton to hook up our country to be patriotic. In fact, in our country, I think very much we are expected to, being patriotic means respecting our own selves and others. And we can pretty much hold people to it. You know, but wait a minute, you know, you're, I can do that certainly with, about women. That's something issue for me that, that I can stop and say, wait a minute. And people, I have the right to be heard. It's sort of, it's an unstated, but then again, it is a stated through the Constitution, you know. And I guess for my kids, it's, I was thinking about that. My kids are essentially, you know, both, you know, one's 17 and one's 20. And our conversations about patriotism have been very, very, very minor. Whereas our conversation from the moment they get taught and interact about how to be loving, you know, is this loving? What would, you know, what would Jesus do? I mean, those conversations about what is loving, what would Jesus do, happen all the time. And that was the base of our family. Patriotism happened in, what is it, a class in, you know, high school, and, where you're, somebody's supposed to teach it, interestingly enough. That's how I think most kids view it.
We're nearing the end of our time, and there's a hand back here. Just one comment before I get to Harry, because one thing that's very striking with your comments, and I think Mark's, is to recognize just how multifaceted our heritage is in this country, and that you can appeal to lots of different aspects of it out of a sense of patriotism. You were talking about the difference of choice, or the difference of rebellion, or these different things, and I think part of it is that it's easy sometimes to get a kind of a monolithic view of patriotism, but many people come into contest with each other because each of them are appealing to a different particular aspect that seems patriotic than to turn to do that. Harry?
I agree with everything that's been said, but what disturbs me is the irony is that our freedom of choice and our right to rebel is the most common justification used to have a military and for military action. And which counters that in my mind.
Well, I think both, you know, I remember both Pete and Mark are saying, you know, that there's all sorts of ways that patriotism gets used to as a justification for things that may or may not have anything to do with. And certainly, I mean, I was looking at the newspaper here, one of the main headlines was Freedom and Justice for All and New Socks for Dad or something like that. I mean, it was just, if you look at the 4th of July sales, the Memorial Day sales, or the, you know, and you just see this over and over again, how much this sort of gets used again to further other interests besides what we might think of as patriotism.
Once again, though, it's the Bible too.
Yeah, you know, right,
the Bible's been used over and over again to promote slavery, to say to put down women, to say that gays and lesbians shouldn't be a part of the church. You know, over and over again, it's been picked apart to people's, you know, to however people want to use it. So there are a lot of links.
Yeah. One of the things we do at Holden is try to end the forums when there's still good conversation going on, so that the conversation can continue from this room. So we're about an hour into this, that's what we try and end on, but I thank you very much for coming out tonight, and I hope this has been helpful. I think that it's made me think of a lot of different things that I want to talk to people about. So enjoy the rest of your evening, and keep up the conversation around the kiosk or on the art. And thanks to our panelists, too, for coming out. Thank you.